What's up, you lazy, entitled, basement-dwelling millennials, bootstrapping boomers, apathetic Xers, and goddamn Gen Z kids today? I'll let you take this was a good entry line.
Holy housing grenade! holy crap! If you've ever thought that like housing was screwed up, we're here to validate that today. Mm-hmm. We're also here not to validate, but in a way validate. All the boomers that did a whole one and done purchase in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And were like, yep, I'm really good at real estate.
Yeah.
You got one. And yeah. You're batting 1,000 off of one hit. Mm-hmm. So, like,
yeah.
Congratulations. that's not the world that we live in today, especially as millennials, Gen Xers, and certainly not as Gen Zers, just making their way into a situation that's very much as least as bad as millennials, if not maybe worse.
Yeah, you know what? I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna go with the hot take that millennials have had it the worst in housing of any generation, at least since the Depression.
Yeah, I mean, at least today, I think that probably Gen Z will turn out to be harder.
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so. Because we came of age during the housing crash.
Yeah.
And didn't have any money to buy houses.
I mean, they got COVID prices right now.
Yeah, well, they do. Well, COVID prices are coming down, though.
Slowly.
Because we came into the market when we had Great Recession issues.
Right.
And then when we finally got enough money where it's like, hey, maybe we can buy a house, then we got COVID prices.
Okay. That's true. It's a double whammy. That's pretty rough.
Where a lot of Gen Z, it wasn't quite in house buying range age at COVID price time.
Sure.
And now they're I'm not saying it's easy. They're definitely getting fucked in the housing market.
Right.
1,000%. They also don't have shitty parents that are like, you're just lazy for not going out and buying a 4-bedroom house and having 37 children.
They can stay in the basements as long as they want.
And we're not going to shame them for it.
No, we're not going to shame them for it. We're going to be like, do you have an extra room in your basement?
Yeah. can we move into our own basement with you? We need to rent out the upstairs to make this fucking happen.
That's exactly right.
Roomies.
Wow.
That's
special.
So
jumping right into it, we are talking about housing today. This is part of our sort of longer term cost of living series, where eventually we are going to hit you with the big shebang, all of it, and it's going to be great.
We haven't figured out what it's going to be yet, but we'll get there.
It's going to be awesome, whatever it is and whatever it looks like. But
like Donald Trump's golden shoes.
Not like that, though. It's definitely not going to be like that. A, it's not going to cost you $400 for an overpriced pair of
the shoes you'll probably never get. Yeah.
But it's actually going to like help you in some way, hopefully. But as for today, we are sort of in a review stage, and we're just going to dig a little bit into things to just kind of start to paint the picture.
Yeah.
To start with housing, let's just jump right into where we are. I have the stinking title as the State of the Union just because of that news segment from, is it Fox or CNN? Whatever it was. I don't
fucking watch cable news, man.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm a millennial.
You pay attention to news, though. So
I pay attention to other people who pay attention to news.
man. Anyways. So basically, as of the fourth quarter in 2023, we're just leaving that quarter. Apparently, about 90% of housing units in the United States are occupied, with around 10% being vacant, and 60% of those housing units are owner occupied, while 30% being renter occupied. And those numbers it's a decent place to start, but it really doesn't even tell the whole picture. So that vacancy number and just like number of occupancy, it doesn't account for homes that are vacant, but not like recently vacant. Like homes kind of like in the unemployment numbers, like where you're recently unemployed or you're looking for jobs. Those are like the vacant homes, and your unemployment number is the occupancy rate. But that doesn't account for like all the homes that are literally not being listed or they're being renovated and to a certain extent where, you know, for a long term. And so those are millions of homes that are not being counted towards the vacancy rate.
Yeah.
Then on top of that, you know, we're seeing a massive rent and housing cost that is, you know, basically unprecedented, at least from where it was like a couple years ago to where it is now. Mm-hmm. That jump is insane. There was a pretty big rise after 2008 once we recovered in the housing market.
Yeah, I mean, housing costs obviously tanked at that time, but nobody had any money to afford this shit anyway, which is why it did tank.
Right. Now it's just expensive, mm-hmm. and we're not making any more money. On our last episode, we went over wages, and your buying power has not increased, but housing costs more.
Certainly has.
So it's not great. It's not, the picture is not good here for people trying to enter the housing market for ownership, or just people trying to rent at a decent proportion of their income ratio.
No.
Like, if you're not trying to be over 30% of your income, you better be making close to six figures, or you better be renting a really crappy studio that's maybe still $1,000 a month.
Go live in a van down by the river.
Right. Some people, it's like a thing now.
That is a thing now.
Van life. It was a thing before COVID, but
it's a different thing now. Now it's like a thing that people are like, posting on social media bragging about, where right. before it was Chris Farley mocking you. So.
Right. All the dudes are like, oh, I pulled myself by my bootstraps by living in a van for a year and working 80 hours a week for that year and not having a day off. It's like, cool, bro. Like, mm-hmm. you just like slaved away your entire year mm-hmm. living in a inadequate housing situation on purpose.
Down by the river.
Like, the best system of economy in the world shouldn't require that you have to do that at some point in your life in order to just get back to a point where you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking weird.
So, I mean, like, for some comparison, back in the early 70s, the median income was around 10K a year, which doesn't sound like dick, but you could buy a house for 30 grand, which also doesn't sound like dick.
But it's the same house that you're buying today for $250,000,
$300,000. Right, right. And so if you're bad at math, 30 grand is three times the annual income of 10 grand. Where today...
Jordan had to pull out the calculator.
I took off my boots, actually. I needed all 10 to count that one, or all 20 to count that one. See what I mean?
Right.
Anyway, today the median income is around 75,000.
Household median income.
Household median. Holy shit, really?
Yeah.
Damn. And the median home cost is 475,000. And the math's a little bit harder on that one. It's 6.5 times your annual median household income. Right.
And the craziest part, not just that it's more than double of what like it should be based mm-hmm. off the 70s rate, but that 70s rate more than likely, was based off of a single and a half mm-hmm. part-time household mm-hmm. income. So you had one person at home, one person mm-hmm. working, and you got that income and you got that, you know, house for that mm-hmm. much. If you would have two people working, that would be an insanely lower amount yeah. of your actual annual income.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, now you're literally working twice as hard because you have twice as many people working in the house,
right.
and your
it still costs twice as much.
Yeah, over twice as much.
Over twice as mm-hmm. much. Yeah, to get the same fucking house that's been there since the 70s. Mm-hmm.
Then, not to mention that comes with new obstacles like down payments. Right. You know, 10% down used to be the norm. Now it's 20% down, and 20% of 475,000 is a hell of a lot more than 10% of 30,000.
Yeah.
To come up with that, which is a big obstacle for people trying to get into a home.
That's right.
Banks are a little bit more stingy to lend to people for a number of reasons. They're sketchy lending practices in the past have something to do with that, and the fact that the bank's carrying a $475,000 loan is a bigger risk than a $30,000 loan, which means that a lot more people have to rent today than they ever used to, because buying a house is a lot more difficult, and so rental prices are going up because there's more demand for rental housing.
Even though rental construction, I think, has probably been bigger than single family household mm-hmm. under $400,000 houses. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. That's still crazy. That is still mm-hmm. enough. And we got the stat. It says that half of U.S. renters are paying over 30% of their income just to rent.
It's insane.
Like, that's mm-hmm. like, if you tried to buy a house with that, they would laugh at you.
Yeah.
They'd be like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. You can't pay 30% of your mortgage
no.
with mm-hmm. your income. Like,
oh, it's true. And so there's lots of theories, lots of intricacies as to why this is a problem, how we got here. And
oh, yeah.
there's obviously corporate ownership of housing is a big topic. A lot of people are talking about it, especially even in Congress. So a lot of people are trying to pass legislation or push legislation that would ban hedge funds and Wall Street from investing in the single family home market.
Yeah. I mean, if only we still had that legislation in place, yeah. You know, the world might be a little bit better place. Thank you, Reagan.
Yeah. You know, it's what's today's date? It is Wednesday, February 21st. And the best news I've heard all day is that Ronald Reagan is still dead.
Yeah. Still gone. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, we didn't learn how to clone humans or, you know, make us yep. immortal on, mm-hmm. you know, before he died. So
also, sorry, you're definitely not going to be hearing this on Wednesday, February 21st. But that's when we were recording it. So,
yeah, I was like, good job. You really, really.
Anyway, so corporate ownership of housing is a big deal. And some people argue that it's not a big deal. And both of those arguments are somewhat true. I guess to really paint the picture of how we got to where we are, we need to go back to the recession. And when,
all the way back.
Yeah. So around 2006, lenders just started lending to anybody and everybody they knew was never going to be able to pay back the loans. And then they would package it into securities and sell it to like retirement funds and shit. And be like, not my problem anymore, bitch. I got mine. And that was not a sustainable business model.
It's weird. I just can't imagine how that could go poorly.
Mm-hmm. So then the world fell apart because they were selling these to people all over the world, and the United States economy leads the world economy. So everything crashed, and then they started repossessing tons and tons of houses, and the U.S. government through, what is it, Freddie Mae and Fannie Mac, or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Yeah,
yeah, one of the two.
Yeah, yeah. Those ones, whatever, which help people get into houses. They ended up with all of these in a very, very similar, almost directly the same way as it did during the Great Depression.
Right.
And then what they did during the Great Depression was they're like, okay, let's do everything we can do to help people keep their houses. So they're like, we will, like, give them, you know, restructured loans that they can afford, and we'll not evict them until they're, you know, a year behind on their payments, and like all this shit. And if we do repossess it, we are going to give them the opportunity to buy it back. And it worked. Like a lot of people came out of the Great Depression, with home ownership and affordable housing and all of that. And, we kind of had the opportunity to do the same, and we're sort of doing that. And then they're like, that seems like a lot of work. And so they're like, why don't we just sell all of the houses at once? In like a big pool. It's way easier to sell like 5,000 houses at the same time to one person than it is to sell 5,000 houses to 5,000 people. And that's what they did. And it turns out the only people who have enough money to buy 5,000 houses at a time are not people.
Investor groups. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so that's what ended up happening is the people who were recession proof because they had all kinds of money going into it. Like, cool, we can buy all of these houses for pennies on the dollar.
Or just too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And so they have to be given hundreds of, you know, mm-hmm. billions of dollars just to survive and then be in a better spot somehow than they yeah. were before they caused the crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but it's that person on food stamps. It's really, you know,
yeah,
dragging us all down.
It's the welfare queen. You mm-hmm. know, they're really just hurting the U.S. Yeah. economy. the whole like tens of thousands of dollars are stealing from the multi-trillion dollar economy of the United States. they're dragging us down.
But anyway, so when this happened, this is really where a larger portion of corporate ownership came into single family homes. And honestly, this was under Obama's watch. This is something that we need to, you know, give criticism where criticism is due.
Yeah, of course.
The Obama administration absolutely handled this like shit, and we could have come out of this.
Well, they did ask the dog who shit on the floor how they should clean it up instead of, you know, like being the adult in the room and be like saying, I'm going to clean it up the right way. So like
after we rub your nose in it, because we didn't do that either, which we really should have rubbed their nose in it. How are they going to learn otherwise?
That's right.
So that that happened, and that's where it really started getting big corporate ownership in housing. But that was a piece of the problem,
right?
Because there was now this huge surplus of housing inventory,
right? Foreclosed homes.
People stopped building houses. A lot of builders went bankrupt.
Yeah, of course.
And so we just had this lull where no new houses were getting built because they weren't worth anything.
But, you know, what's happening at the same time, if no new houses being built, people are still having some babies.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people keep fucking all the time.
That's the one constant of the world. Really, you know, if we could tie that to some sort of energy source. I don't know.
Miracles just a belt, maybe.
Miracles could happen. Just saying.
Perpetual motion.
That's right.
Anyway, so stop building houses. So inventory lagged. And then when stuff started to pick back up, the builders who had weathered the storm, started building more expensive houses because with limited inventory, there's more demand for it. It's easier to build a $300,000 house than it is to build a $100,000 house. Well, it's the same energy, but you get more money out of it in the end.
Right. Yeah. A little bit extra increased in the, labor and the material costs, but a exponential increase for profits.
So they started building not entry level homes, which made
you're right. $300,000 homes 10 years ago, $400,000-$500,000 homes now.
So the problem got worse for everybody trying to get into entry level houses. And then when you started getting that huge increase in property value, rich greedy fucks who have money to buy all of the property started doing that more and more. And now you'll hear some different arguments to this this perspective. A lot of people will argue that mass corporate ownership in the housing market isn't a real problem. Like, it's not a huge percentage. We talked about this a little bit.
Just the basis of that statement is crazy to me. It's like, do people want to own homes? Like, is that the dream that has been sold to them, somewhat propagandized by the American government and banks, of which it is to own a home? And even if it is propagandized, it's still the best wealth driver for most Americans. And you're going to take that away by mass corporate ownership of single family homes? If you were to argue me that that's a good thing, I would love to hear anybody try.
I had maybe not my most graceful moment on TikTok in an argument with somebody else about this, where they were arguing that's not the real problem is corporate ownership. And again, I fully acknowledge that there is other outlying issues here.
Yeah, of course.
Because what national corporate ownership in housing is relatively low, around like 1%, I think.
Yeah, it's like just over 1% nationally, which is like, if you think about that, you're like, oh, well, who cares then?
Yeah.
Like that's got to be tiny.
But there's a problem, which I felt was the problem that I was arguing with in this particular exchange. Was that, yeah, sure, 1.6% nationwide is when you're, like, averaging in, like, Lincoln, Nebraska and shit, right?
Right.
You got to think that there's certain places people want to live, and that's
right.
That's not Lovell, Wyoming,
no.
Of all places. And so the people with money aren't going to buy property in those shitty places nobody wants to live. They're going to be
concentrated.
Mm-hmm. And where is everybody moving to?
Well, right now it's the South, mm-hmm. Sun Belt.
And if you start looking at the percentage of corporate ownership in those places, 5% in Georgia, mainly Atlanta, 4% in Florida, 3% in Arizona and North Carolina. No, 4% in Arizona, 3% North Carolina and Tennessee, 2% in Texas, Indiana, and South Carolina. That's getting into more notable percentage of the housing market in places where more people are trying to move.
That's right.
They accounted, large corporations accounted for 31% of purchases in Miami last year, 27% in Miami, 25% in Jacksonville, 20% in Atlanta, Phoenix, L.A., again, that's a huge portion of, so of all the houses sold in those areas in that year, they don't account for owning that total amount, but of all the houses sold during that time.
Right. Yeah.
They purchased that many.
It's like, so like the housing market, like we think right now, and especially in those markets, there's a lack of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to say like, what would make housing more affordable or less affordable? Would it be adding 25% more people living in those areas? Would that make it better or worse?
Way worse.
You could think worse, yeah, and mm-hmm. you'd be right. Like, that's an insane thing. Mm-hmm. It impacts those specific markets, and those are the markets where people want to be, mm-hmm. where the jobs are at, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to have a huge impact on everyday lives of Americans who are just trying to buy a home where they live, mm-hmm. you know, to exist.
So I mean, right in those numbers alone is where, you can already start to see a problem. And the further you dig into it, the worse it gets. In the past 3 years, investors have purchased, 25% of all single family homes that have sold. Like,
sure.
So every one that's hit the market that sold, 25%, a quarter of them. And When you dig even further, you start to look at the types of houses they're buying.
Mm-hmm.
90% of those purchases were houses under $300,000.
I would think those would be the prime houses for millennials mm-hmm. and Gen Zers.
And so when you're talking, that's the whole point, right? When you're talking about trying to get into a house, first-time home buyers,
right.
Because once you get into your first house, buying another house in the future is a lot easier. Like, the biggest obstacle is going from having no net worth, basically,
right,
to owning a home and building some equity, and then that equity can get you into a nicer house further down the road, and so on and so forth.
Right.
But those are the houses that are being competed for with major corporations and investors that own more than, you know, 11 properties. They're not buying the $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 houses on average. They're buying the little houses that they can either rent out or turn around.
Or they're buying houses that, you know, need to be repaired a little bit. And so they can afford to inject $200,000 into it and then sell it or rent it out, you know, being a $500,000 home, and they don't care about the low or about the short-term cost of that.
Nope.
They're looking at mm-hmm. what can I do with the long-term rental market, because they know that housing is an inelastic good. People mm-hmm. always need it.
Yeah.
So, like, they're willing to outbid people who mm-hmm. are also willing to put in that sweat equity
mm-hmm.
but can't do cash offer, or like aren't willing to go 10 or 20% above asking price on the short term because mm-hmm. they don't have the money. And so they get completely shafted, completely, you know, pushed out of that market. And this is lower income families or mm-hmm. just first time home buyers in your, you know, in your 20s mm-hmm. when people are like, this is when you should buy a home, start a family. Can't do that in today's world. It's really, really tough.
Yeah. And then to add on to that, when people try to downplay these numbers, you think so, investors purchased a third of entry-level homes, right?
Right.
And when you're looking to sell a house, you look at other houses that have sold in that community, mm-hmm. and that's what you base your pricing on. So if you have a community and three houses are sold in this little neighborhood of this particular community, and one of those was investor purchased and went for 20% over asking price, the other two that are coming up for sale are also going to use that as a factor in how they're pricing their houses,
like,
and that starts to drive the market. That's where they're going to start with their asking prices.
Yeah.
And that is where a lot of people don't realize that it doesn't need to be a huge percentage to have huge impacts on the on that price market.
Right. Well, it's like basically, it's not price fixing, but like it's, you know, they call it price leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd use that a lot in the rental market, but it kind of filters its way into just like the, you know, entry-level home or just home purchasing market. Obviously,
absolutely.
Inflation of prices have been incredibly insane. Like, it doesn't make sense how much, like, people always point to, oh, with COVID, people wanted to be at home more, and so they wanted more space. It's like, they were already existing at home.
Mm-hmm.
They already had a place to live, and probably they're just working in their living room anyway.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, Emily has an office. She spends most fucking days in the living room.
Hey, watch it. No, but like that's the people point to that all the time. It's like that doesn't make sense. Like that's not enough of a factor for home prices to raise like 60, 80, like a fucking tens and percentage. Yep. Like that doesn't add up.
Yep.
But investors purchasing, you know, 90% of homes that are on the market for under $300,000 in the last 3 years. Oh, well, that might make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, just to clarify, it was 90% of investors purchasing homes were under 300,000.
90% of the homes that they purchased were under 300,000. Mm-hmm. My bad. Yeah.
We're all about clarity here, you know. and then the other thing that gets talked about a lot is home vacancy. And this is another thing that got brought up in that discussion I had. That vacancy isn't really that big of a deal. And there's some factors. One of the things that was brought up was like, oh, if, you know, you sold your house, but the other person hasn't moved into it yet, and they move in a little bit later, but when they took the survey, no one was living there, that's counted as vacant. But I don't have any numbers specifically to back this up, but I feel like as far as where people live and move, those kind of vacancy rates stay the same all the time. Like, that's not something that's going to change over time, because you're moving... When you move into a new house, there's kind of always that transition period. Well,
and you have to sell your house generally to buy the next one. So, like, it doesn't usually stay vacant for very long.
Right. And so, like, as long as basically the roughly same number of people are moving for...
Yeah, well, and there should be more because there's more people. So, like, that should be dropping year to year unless we build more houses.
And then, obviously, like, houses that are condemned or unlivable are a part of this. But one thing that I couldn't find that made it really difficult to put a number on was short-term rentals.
Mm.
Because a lot of companies, I feel like these investor people who buy homes, especially in desirable places to live and visit.
Yeah.
Are using them for like Airbnb and short-term rentals. And if you're using a bunch of single family homes as a place where nobody's living, it's vacant.
Right. Yeah. But is it counted towards vacancy?
It is counted towards vacancy. If there's somebody not living there more than 6 months of the year, it's counted as a vacant or semi-vacant. So the 16 million vacant homes in the US, you know, so that's how many there is, 16 million, which is a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of those, are being renovated or waiting to be sold or rented, uninhabitable. Vacation homes, you know, some rich people get to own more than one home, and that's nice for them.
Yeah, right.
Or short-term rentals. There's 5 million short-term rentals, just exclusive short-term rentals in the country right now. So
family home short-term rentals?
Single family home short-term rentals. Gotcha. So that doesn't include, you know, apartment or not apartment buildings.
Condos
but,
or whatever.
Hotels and that kind of
hotels,
stuff.
Hotels, sure.
It'd probably include condos, I would assume, because that would still be considered a single family. Maybe no, that wouldn't be considered a single family home. So it probably doesn't include condos. That probably just
includes...
I guess
when I think of single family home, I think a detached.
Yeah, it would have to be because like a duplex isn't considered a single family home. Yeah, so it would have to be. It's single family homes was the stat. It would be 5 million single family homes used exclusively for short-term rentals. So of the 16 million vacant homes, a third of those are short-term rentals.
I just don't... Why would we allow
for single family homes to become used in that way. Like, it, clearly, especially in a in a market today where we don't have enough homes, or the market appears to have a shortage of homes, like, what are we doing sitting on these and just allowing somebody to drive up the price for the rest of the market while depriving a home from people?
Yeah, it's
seems like the worst of both situations for average Americans. Not that our country works for average Americans for the most part, but like,
yeah. And what was hard for me too with this was I couldn't find how many of these are corporate owned versus individually owned. The numbers are very obscure, and most of them are from like Realty agent, like Realty organizations and stuff. It's not, there's no, I couldn't find any government, government statistics on who owns these single family short term rentals.
Yeah. And it's not even like the easiest to find like what a specific company owns, you know, homes and where those homes are. Like, you
and what
have
they're
to,
used for. Yeah.
You kind of have to do some digging. Not that it's impossible.
Yep.
If you're in the, you know, the Realty, you know, market, or just like you work in that environment, you probably can find it a little bit easier. But like, it's still, for the average person, you would not find an easy place to find that information.
Yeah. No, I looked all over for it because I wanted to know how many of those are just, you know, mom and pop having one short-term rental that's a single family house versus, you know, BlackRock or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And
Celebration Homes. And then the other argument that always got brought up in this topic was that these companies are allowing homes to sit vacant to drive up prices, and people will argue that, well, why would they do that? That's not a good investment, and those people are stupid.
I mean, to a certain extent, they have a point, but there's an actual point of, if there, it's a tactic used in many rental markets all across the world, is if there's less housing supply in the rental market, then that'll drive the cost up to rent and or purchase other homes that they may own. So,
and then think about this: is even if that wasn't the case, which it absolutely is, but that increasing price, especially with the low interest rates that we've had for so long.
Sure.
If your property is going to increase by 30, 40, or 50%, your investment, and you're paying 2 or 3% interest or no interest if you paid cash on it, and it sits there vacant, you're still making money. You're making way better money than you're going to make on, you know, in the stock market or something like that. You can afford to. So you can limit that supply on the market for your other homes. And it doesn't mean they can be trying to be renting them, quote unquote, trying and putting some ridiculous price on it.
Yeah, exactly.
And either somebody's going to pay it and they're going to make a killing, or nobody's going to pay it and the it's going to drive up the prices of everything else available in the area. So there's absolutely motivation in certain markets for companies to overprice rentals to,
oh my
to
God.
Let them sit there
and
make
you can
it.
See it clear as day. Like, it's very easy to see if you go on to like, if you go to rentals on Zillow, like, you can see, like, they have their logos on the picture sometimes. Feel like, this is the company who owns the property. And, like, you can see them, like, dropping their price every couple months. And to the point where it's like, you're basically just paying what, you know, the mortgage is, or just a little bit above it. And you could see where they had renters, like, at a certain price, and then they jacked it up and kicked them out. And then for the next 6 months, they've been lowering it. And then it gets to below what the rate they were renting it out was. Like, it sometimes it doesn't even make sense. They're just doing it to raise the, you know, the value of renting in that market,
and it's a risk worth taking because it's not really a risk. They're not losing out on that much money because the property's still increasing in value.
Right.
I mean, it's they say property's always a good investment, and that's what they were doing there. So again, I couldn't find any specific statistics on corporations' strategy, and this is something obviously they play pretty close to the vest.
I mean,
they're not coming
not gonna,
out on their,
you know, BlackRock's not going to come out and be like, "Yeah, this is exactly what we're doing." Like, that, it's hard to do.
But it is plausible that this is a cognitive business strategy that they are employing, And that there should be less housing vacancy than there currently is, considering the demand.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess, and this is a pure question, is is there a actual housing shortage, or is there just a sort of vacancy, like a fake vacancy level that creates a shortage of housing?
I do believe that there is a housing shortage. I do believe that we do not have enough of the type of housing that we need currently to meet the demand. That said, we have enough housing to house everybody, in theory.
Right. Just clearly, most of those people can't afford to buy it.
Can't afford it, or the housing isn't necessarily where the people want to be or need to be.
Yeah.
Again, going back to the like Level Wyoming example, like, yeah, sure, there's or Detroit. Detroit's a great example. There's a bunch of empty houses in Detroit.
Yeah.
In theory, a lot of those could probably house people, but there's no work for them to have there. There's you have those kinds of issues. So there's the intricacies there in that situation of, yeah, we could in theory house everybody. There may be enough housing inventory technically, but practically probably not. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we didn't build enough after the recession, and then the types of stuff we started building wasn't what we needed. But the problem is greatly exacerbated by the fact that we have these short-term rentals. We have investors investing most heavily in entry-level housing. And then we don't have any government incentives or restrictions on making sure that the types of housing we need are built. And the type of people who should be buying them are the ones who have the opportunities to buy them.
Right, which kind of leads into, I've got this whole thing about public housing in here, and in the housing Department of Housing and Urban Development, apparently they used to actually like fund building of homes or like actual developments, and most of it was supposed to be spent on building like entry-level low-income-ish type housing, which I thought was like, wow, what a novel freaking thing to have the government be building homes for lower income people in the areas that they need to be built in.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that would be like. Right. That's incredible. Apparently, we do still build somewhere around 5,000 to 7,000 homes every year on the federal basis, on that basis.
Okay.
But 5,000 to 7,000 homes.
Not much.
Yeah. No, that's not even really replacement level for housing demand. So it's pretty bad. Mm-hmm. But was not always the case. Apparently, in 1979, Congress authorized 55,000 units to be built under public housing.
Yep.
And then, you know, Reagan happened.
Fuck them poor people.
In 1984, they authorized zero. And basically, between 1979 and now, it's averaged around 7,500. Mm-hmm. So basically, I did a little bit of math, and apparently, if we had maintained our pace in 1979 of 55,000 units per year, we would have built 2 million homes over that time period.
Yep.
And there's 700,000 or less currently homeless people living in this country, and there's a couple million that are living in overcrowded, inadequate housing, just like really shitty housing. So just think about what we could have, you know, knocked out of that group with just maintaining this like pretty like 40-year-old or 50-year-old statistic of building. Like, we would be in an immensely better position than where we are today.
Well, and to that point, we want to go back to Make America Great Again.
Right. Pre-Reagan, that's honestly.
Well, even before FDR, even under Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, you're giving some chops to Woodrow?
I fucking hate Woodrow Wilson. Horrible, horrible, horrible president, horrible man in every sense of the word. But we did some good stuff in wars domestically, you know, until 1945. And then we were like, let's just...
Well, so... basically throughout the 1900s, we our foreign policy was absolutely dog shit.
It was. It was. But anyway, after World War One or during World War One, we built a bunch of housing for soldiers and war effort reasons. And it was permanent housing. We built, it wasn't temporary shit. So it lasted, you know, it was like 120,000+ houses built, during and right after World War One to house soldiers and government personnel for the war effort. And then following World War Two, FDR, New Deal, all that, we, all of the suburbs, all of those old suburbs from the 50s, 40s and 50s, all of those old cookie cutter box houses, that was all government incentive, government paid for. Right. This is what we need. This is what you're building. Go out and do it. Here's the land. Here's the money. That whole American dream thing, that's the government paid for it. The government
made it affordable.
It affordable, put rules on how much you could charge, you know, who could own it.
Such a novel concept.
Yeah, I mean, granted, it wasn't, we didn't allow certain people to own it that we probably should have, but, you know, we'll
the idea was good, flawed in its execution.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was the time of redlining and all that bullshit, but the government built houses, lots of houses, and a lot of the houses we're still fighting over today because the government stopped fucking doing it when Ronald Reagan's like, why should we use your tax money to help you?
Right. I heard that's just supposed to go to funding our campaigns and paying for federal agencies that we're going to strip, but also make them ineffectual.
Yeah. Well, no, we need to give it back to the people who paid for our...
there's that. There's that. Yeah, I guess in the 1980s, in 1981, the HUD had a $32 billion budget. And then by the end of the decade, 1989, their budget was around $7 billion.
Holy shit.
So they got a 80% reduction in their budget in a span of 10 years, which coincidentally is, you know, right around when housing started to a little bit.
Started to gain a little bit
of steam.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was not the best time for being a person who was not a millionaire at the time. Reagan.
He drains
my soul every time I think about his existence.
It's
but again, this is nuance and I can't blame everything on Reagan, although I can blame most of it on Reagan.
He definitely attributed good portion to it, that's for sure.
One of the, I guess, last big issues on why there's housing shortages and why it's difficult to fix the housing shortage problem is zoning. And we've talked about this a little bit in the past. But a lot of zoning regulations in a lot of places prevent people from building multifamily homes.
Right.
You know, duplexes, quadplexes, apartment buildings. The kind of stuff that makes it easier to fit more people in less space and give them a place to live, condos, so on. And that also, hurts for public transportation, for getting people to and from work.
Yeah,
and
proliferates
like that
throughout our lives. Mm-hmm. And we do have a whole episode on zoning already out there that focuses a lot on that. I would highly recommend it if you feel like zoning is rough. We have talked about that.
Yeah. So we're not going to get too deep into it, but that is another factor as to why it's difficult for housing to get built to meet demand at this point, and we need to do a lot of rezoning. A lot of it was, you know, good intentioned. Obviously, a lot of it was really poorly intentioned to keep certain people out.
A little bit of racism involved
there definitely
just
was.
Just a little bit.
But wherever you go, zoning laws, like even in rural Minnesota where I live, in Chisago County, like they've got laws against putting trailer houses on your property, and this is in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Well, trailer houses are affordable housing for a lot of people. Yeah. And if you you can't do that, it makes it a little bit more difficult to add housing units when you have to build a foundation, a stick-built house. So those kinds of obstacles are sort of the behind-the-scenes obstacles as to why we have some issues in meeting that demand.
Right. Well, and it just all the incentives of new housing has dried up, as we've kind of already pointed out, post-World War II. Like the government spent a lot of money on education and housing on our economy post-World War II. And
we don't anymore.
We don't. When people talk about Make America Great Again, they're talking about that time period. Mm-hmm. They're talking about
socialized time in American
socialized
history.
Socialized healthcare, housing, education, and high corporate taxes, baby.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
This is what makes America great.
You want to fix our problems? That's how you fix them.
It's that simple. Like, and people, especially MAGA people, they don't actually look at like what does that look like back then. They're like, oh no, there's just less black people around me, so that's the best time in America.
That was great. Don't you remember?
That's the only thing they remember.
Share the water fountains and shit.
Right.
All right. Well, so once again, we've told you everything you probably already know or feel in your soul to be true.
Yeah, we're sort of validating you here.
Yeah, just the reason that you're still living in your parents' basement. This is a big reason as to why. Don't feel so bad.
Hopefully you're not in your parents' basement.
Hopefully not. But if you are,
don't understand that.
And if you're just struggling day to day to make that one bedroom apartment payment, or you know you want to buy a house and you keep getting turned down for loans, or keep getting outbid, this is why. And it's again a very complex issue. There's a lot of reasons, and it's easy to just blame one specific thing. But there is solutions. We're just not doing them. But we can vote for the people who want to start implementing these solutions.
Sort of.
Yeah.
We can try to vote
We can
for
pretend.
Them. They don't usually make it to the point where we can vote for them because they usually get cut down in the primary process. But
very true.
But that's another topic that we've talked about, and we will talk about some
Been
more.
Been there, done that. All right. So this is episode 2 in our, three or four part series on
at
this.
At least. There's more parts.
There's going to be more on this. Sorry we're dragging you through on this one, but we appreciate you hanging out with us, listening to us validate why your life sucks today. All of our lives suck. It's not just you.
At least why living in America and literally living in a house in America is
just
really tough.
Surviving. So we appreciate you. We appreciate you listening. Yeah. We will see you next week. As always, follow us on all the socials.
That's right.
Off Your Wagon. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube. You can watch the podcast if you're listening and you prefer video form. You can see that on Off Your Wagon's YouTube under the Let Them Eat Toast playlist.
That's right.
You can get merchandise at offjawagon.com. We've got stickers for Let Them Eat Toast and some other merch we're working on for Let Them Eat Toast, plus everything else. All the money you spend there helps us do this. We appreciate you. If you like what we're doing, just keep listening. Buy stuff. Tell your friends about us.
That's right. Word of mouth. Let's go.
we love you guys. We appreciate you. And we will see you next week on Let Them Eat Toast.
That's right. Thanks for tuning in.